Coiled Spring, Episode 3.
Sit tight and listen keenly while I play for you another brand new musical biscuit.
Hello, and welcome to The Coiled Spring, the podcast with potential. I'm your host, Matthew Petty. We've got guests, reviews of American cultural artifacts, general faffing about, special musical presentations, and various other things when the ideas come. Pop along to coiledspring.org to leave feedback, and thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Tom Murphy, and you're listening to The Coiled Spring.
For this episode, my guest is Tom Murphy. He's a native Bay Arean, a musician, an advocate for musicians' rights, and all-round good apple, or good egg, or some other grocery product. I cornered him in his apartment, and as it happened, it was the weekend of Fleet Week here in San Francisco, which means there might have been some aeroplanes going past in the background. Hopefully that won't detract from what turned out to be a very interesting and, informative conversation. We talked about all sorts of things, especially focusing on music, and of course it's a big interest for Tom. He's a musician himself and does a lot of work for advocacy for live music and recorded music in San Francisco. And as a result, we got talking about music technology and, in fact, the up-and-coming, at that time, Audio Engineering Society convention.
It's a convention that's been going on, I don't even know, maybe 40, 50, 60 years.
Okay.
For professional engineers and recording technical people and manufacturers. So it began with the people making microphones and speakers, but it's grown to all these computer workstation people and all the different effects processors and all the electronics around the production of sound.
Yeah.
And then they also host a series of technical papers about all the fancy math and physics and acoustics things. So there's something for everyone.
but not musicians necessarily.
So I would say more and more musicians are going to this kind of thing because they're sort of, being a musician these days isn't just about playing your instrument, it's about all the technology around it.
Yeah, well, I suppose you could say also that, and this ties into what I was saying to my previous guest, about the democratization of technology and allowing creativity more easily. And in that, when we were talking about it then, it was talking about like indie video games, where it kind of harks back to the bedroom programmers of the early 80s. And you can now do professional, almost professional level recording with in your bedroom or wherever, in your garage. And so, yeah, it makes sense that more musicians would be going to these more engineer-based trade shows because there's stuff there that they can afford and use well.
Yeah, it used to be, you know, a convention like the Audio Engineering Society, it was for people who own recording studios, people who own broadcast facilities, you know, people who have very high million-dollar budgets every year. You know, they buy a ton of equipment, they have a big loan, their business is around, can I generate enough income to pay off the loan? Mm. It depreciates over time, and every few years, I need to retire some old equipment and buy some new equipment.
Right.
Those days are pretty much over. Lots of recording studios have sort of fallen by the wayside in the last few years.
Really?
That
because of this democratization?
Yes,
think,
because a musician can spend, you know, a couple hundred dollars and be able to do work at home.
Yeah.
Instead of hiring an engineer in a soundproof room.
Yes.
With you know, an air condition, a huge air conditioning budget and electricity budget,
and
a staff of, you know, four or five people.
Right, right.
So
rent.
Right.
Gosh.
Security alarms and it, you know,
for all the equipment and everything. Yeah. Oh gosh.
Kind of a double-edged sword of, on the one hand, it's great that musicians have access to this technology.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, engineers, other sort of talented technical people,
yeah,
have found it harder to earn a living.
It's almost like they need to, well, they need to, but it's almost like they could become roaming freelance engineers who will come and debug your home recording setup and get you set up and recording, and they've got the expertise to actually know which knobs to twiddle.
Definitely.
And you can hire their time, and they'll come to you, to your little place, and they'll get it all working for you, and you can have a session, and then they leave you to it, and then they move on to the next. But they don't have their own premises.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it really, part of this democratization means you can actually perform and record and create music just about anywhere.
Yes.
And that's a very exciting thing, that you're not limited to, we're going to save up a bunch of money.
Yeah.
We're going to wait until the fall of next year, and then we're going to block out a studio for 2 weeks and try to get it all done in that short amount of time.
Yeah. Yes, and I think music shows, you know, I guess it's always been the way. Some people can just sort of bash out a little thing on a four track or in their bedroom now. But it shows in the style of music, I think, that big productions still need a big setup.
Definitely. I mean, what I've seen is kind of when I first got involved in music and sound, I was a kid in grammar school, and my goal was to learn all the technical stuff.
Yeah.
Learn how to open up equipment and solder it and fix it.
Yeah.
And, you know, keep it all running and learn all the technical parts of being in a studio and then get a job at a recording studio.
Right.
Because that's where all the good equipment was. That's where, you know, they could afford all the good stuff.
Yes.
But then I worked in a studio for a little while. I eventually fell into a job at a company called DigiDesign that made the first computer recording equipment.
Okay.
And it brought the prices down. It made the access easier.
Yeah.
And over the years, you know, more and more technology has exploded.
Uh-huh.
You get more and more features and the potential of creation is at your fingertips.
Yes. Which can be a crippling responsibility, I think. Speaking as a frustrated musician myself, and frustrated in the sense of not having any musical ability. But
that could be kind of frustrating.
Yeah, it's a bit of a hiccup. And it's a gap that you can't fill with technology, but the temptation is there to try and fill it with technology.
Right. Well, and so as technology has really just exploded, I think it's been interesting to see over the years how some music has benefited from that greatly, and
yeah,
other artists who the world, you know, never would have heard of, you know,
yeah,
have now found them.
Yeah.
I think there's also the danger, though, that it also has confused the marketplace, where so much music is being created,
uh-huh,
just the sheer volume, that not all of it is the most exciting artistic work.
True, but then this comes into play as well, because you've got with the indie games, because the distribution is also much more democratized now. Mm-hmm. If it's good, people will notice, because there are so many platforms where people can notice. It's the good stuff does kind of rise to the top. Mostly.
In theory, that's great.
In theory, that's great.
And I believe, you know, I'm all for the democratization of music.
Yeah.
I feel, though, we're still kind of right in the middle of that transition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's all these services right now with millions of songs available. You can listen to anything you want.
Yes.
But with that availability, how you actually find music that relates to you,
yes,
gets harder and harder.
Yes.
You know, in the early days, back when, you know, the labels and radio had the monopoly on music.
Right.
They were evil corporate enterprises.
Yes.
You only knew about a band because a record label had spent a lot of money to put a record out, and they were paying to have them tour the country, and you'd hear about them coming to your town, and they'd come to your record store, and you know, the amount of bands that you had any exposure to was very small.
Yes.
But there's still, there was the rock station or the country station or the college station. Like, you could still gravitate to a certain area and find some of what you liked.
Yes.
Today, when they say, here's 2 million songs, pick one. I think we're just in the middle of, what's happened is you had a built-in set of filters of people who listened to music, who picked what they liked, who they picked what they thought other people would like, and some of the choice was filtered out just by design.
Yeah.
And what's happened is we're sort of in the middle of making our new filters.
Yes. You know? And well, I mean, there's been some efforts to try and automate that filtering. Obviously, there's personal recommendation stuff, or even anonymous stranger recommendation, where, you know, people who liked this also liked, but then that can work. But because music, and I guess all creative works, are subject to such subjective opinions about whether they're good or not, if someone liked this, they should also like this, is not always true. And I remember being told, because I think, I can't remember, what was that website where you told it what you liked and it told you, and it wasn't based on recommendation, it was based on the structure of the music and the style of the instrumentation and so on. I think it might have been like the...
There have been a number of... I think there was one called Mood Logic that was kind of...
I think it might have been the one that Pandora plays on, I think. Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
The Genome.
The Music Genome, that's right. And I told it I liked Echo and the Bunnymen. Mm-hmm. And it said, well, in that case, you'll like U2 then. Mm-hmm. And I really don't.
Right.
I can't stand U2. And it's not necessarily a musical opinion that I don't like U2. And because there's so much else around it. And it said, but I wasn't actually arguing with the computer, but it said, well, you should like them. And I was like, because they have this kind of particular style of guitar and the...
Right. Harmonically,
the structure of the songs is often the same, and the vocals could be said to be similar. I'm like, how dare you compare Bono's vocals to Ian McCulloch? So I thought, no,
right.
And like, but so it comes down to opinion, and you know.
Right. Well, and that's where technology is going to keep coming up with really neat, amazing things. And sonically, you can create algorithms that listen to the harmonic content, and this is guitar-oriented stuff, this is piano or synth-oriented stuff,
yes,
this is a male vocalist or a female vocalist. There's lots of ways you can try and break it down. But kind of in the world of human experience, there's so many other intangibles that no one particular technology is going to be an exact match to
to everyone.
You know, you would go to a certain bar or club. Part of it was because the music was there, and part of it was the people who were there, and part of it was the drinks they had. And so liking music has so many more levels that you can't just map a computer to.
And talking about the personal thing as well, I mean, especially when it's a small group who don't have much exposure... You might, if they're a local band, for example, you might meet them, think they're dicks, and as a result not want to listen to their music.
Right.
And so that's just, you know, but it's exactly the kind of music you like. Yeah, but he's a dick.
Right. Or you love this band because they play at a bar down the street.
Right.
And they don't sound anything like anything else you listen to, but you know them, and so you buy their music, and you
support
have an affinity to them.
Hi, I'm Kristen McGorry, and you're listening to The Coiled Spring.
Thank you very much.
I made it sound a bit sexy there, didn't I?
Okay, it's time for snack reviews, and it's about time I got round to the snack that you're all waiting for, and of course it's the famous Hostess Twinkie. The Hostess Twinkie, a golden sponge cake with creamy filling. You all know about these. They appear in they're an American cultural artifact of the highest degree, and so I'm going to eat one now and tell you what I think. So it comes in a clear cellophane package on a little bit of cardboard. with two cakes sitting nestled nicely next to each other, pressing up against the cellophane with a kind of a strange, glistening oiliness. And here we are. Let's have a look. They're stuck to the cardboard. They're not squished this time because I've been careful not to squish my review subjects from now on. So let's have a look. They're kind of... Yeah, they've got a kind of a glucosey, oily, sticky feel to them. And it's a golden sponge cake. And let's have a taste. Well, that is pretty nasty, has to be said. The cake is a cloying, artificial sponge. The cream filling is the same NASA byproduct that we've encountered in previous reviews. And from on the bottom of the cake, the bottom of the cake is flat, and there are three holes where the cream filling has been injected. And so, I mean, I actually don't want to eat this anymore. I mean, in previous reviews, I've said, oh, this is quite nice, a bit of frosting and all that stuff. This, on the other hand, is nasty, and it's, I want to wipe my fingers, and I want to rinse my mouth out. But you're glad I did this, aren't you? You're very grateful, I can tell. So there we have it, Hostess Twinkie. This is what Woody Harrelson was searching for in Zombieland. This is what Egon Spengler was comparing the amount of ectoplasm in New York. Luckily, this Twinkie is not 20 feet long. It is about 4 inches long and 1.5 inches wide. And all of that is nasty. So, you know, thanks for sticking with it. Why did I do that? That's disgusting.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
When I moved to the city about 4 years ago, I was taking a break from the tech thing, and I began to see a lot of local music. And I was trying to figure out what job I wanted to do next. And as I began to see live shows, I really kind of had a new connection to music.
Okay.
That I saw these bands who... I liked the sound of their music, but then I also got to know about them personally. You know, I could see their character, their personality. And it was music I never would have sought out on my own. Like, I wouldn't have done any Google searches for these bands. I might have sort of glossed over them if I listened to a couple tracks on YouTube. But I kind of had the realization that live music is that moment where the fan and the artist connect.
Yes.
Like, that's the essence of what music is all about, is...
Live music, yeah.
The song is played, and there's a connection between the artist and the fan.
But the connection might be different for every fan in the crowd.
Whatever the connection is...
It still
all these,
crystallizes in that moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And all these technologies are trying to reproduce that moment in some way. To put in front of a listener, a band, that a connection will be made.
Yes.
Oh, I like this band. I want to buy this song. I want to subscribe to their channel.
Yes.
I want to follow them on Twitter. Whatever it is, there's that moment, that human moment, that can't be synthesized.
Right.
And so over the course of a few months, I realized I bought more music in those 3 months at the merchandise table in the back of a club.
There you go.
Than I had bought CDs over the last 5 or 10 years, because there's so much online. I've subscribed to lots of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where I felt any technology that tries to find that moment, you know, to connect the fan with the band, that local is kind of, I think, where we all need to sort of find that again.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because Microsoft or Sony or Apple or Google, like, they're all going to duke it out for a while. Like,
yeah.
And we have no control over that huge global arms race.
That's right.
But we do have control over seeing somebody who's in town.
Yes.
And so that's where I felt what the thing that's going to save the music business is live music.
Absolutely. Well, it's, I mean, you say about the music business. I mean, the music business as it stands at the moment, it could be said to be dying, and rightly so. But that's a music business, a particular model of music business.
And when I guess when I say the music business, I talk about the business of a musician creating art
and receiving and
earning a living doing
yeah.
so.
That's cool.
And being able to pay their own bills by that.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
And once I heard about that, kind of once I had that revelation, I began to see all these news stories about clubs in San Francisco in trouble.
Right.
Getting threatened to be getting shut down to face fines by the alcohol and beverage control up in Sacramento.
So you're also very much involved in the, well, how do you describe it? The advocacy for independent musicians or?
Yeah, so when I moved to the city and I kind of had my aha moment of feeling that live music is a place where fans and artists connect, and you can sort of reinvigorate, kind of the industry through that. I began to hear about a lot of trouble for clubs in the city, facing legal challenges, facing problems with their licenses, really being at risk of being closed down. And I was shocked that the one thing that I thought was working in the music space of bands touring and getting people turned on to their stuff was actually in trouble. That Slim's, Bottom of the Hill, Cafe du Nord, Great American Music Hall, all these clubs were racking up thousands of dollars in legal fees and were talking about if things didn't change, they might have to close down for good.
Legal fees for what?
So I began to try to research that.
Okay.
And that's where I had heard about how the Recording Academy, the Grammy people, has a local chapter here in San Francisco, and a number of people within the Academy were actually going to become more interested in this topic and become active. And so I joined the Academy and very quickly got on what they call their advocacy committee.
Okay.
Advocacy in the Recording Academy is really about trying to address political and social issues that affect musicians.
Okay.
You know, they're well known for the Grammy Awards.
Yes.
Which is seen as sort of the symbol of excellence in music recording and production. Mm-hmm. Kind of the, it's a group of the people who vote for the awards are the same people who make music. So it's not just Everybody in America Loves Green Day.
Right.
This is the people involved in creating music kind of might have a better gauge of is it well written song, is it a well recorded song.
You can't leave that kind of thing up to people.
Right. It's not just a popularity contest. That,
my God.
You know,
maybe to the experts.
And they give awards out to, you know, the producer of the year, the engineer of the year.
Right.
So it's about the whole process, not just is it popular. They also have a number of groups within the organization. One is called Music Cares that deals with helping artists in trouble, in duress. So if an artist comes down with an illness, maybe he can't pay his medical bills.
Yeah.
They actually can help pay for artists' medical bills.
That's awesome, yeah.
If an artist passes away, maybe they help the family. There's also this advocacy group that deals with kind of political issues facing musicians. Issues about copyright bills
in
Washington. Issues around royalties and reporting and some of the business issues or legal issues.
Yeah.
With the FCC and radio broadcasting or television. And so I got involved because I felt here in San Francisco there was this challenge that live music was in jeopardy of kind of falling by the wayside. And when I began to look into the issues further, I learned that it wasn't a problem with underage drinking or violence at clubs or, you know, kind of any of the stereotypical problems you might think of, you know, rock getting out of control or
those rock and rollers,
you know, urban people, you know, having trouble. This was an issue of partially due to the economy, that Sacramento was beginning to try to generate revenue from fining people.
Oh, boy.
And so there were loopholes in the licenses for any club that had 18 and up. So it had underage patrons.
Yes.
There was a technicality that they needed to have a certain amount of their receipts be from food.
This
arbitrary number that just says 30% of your revenue has to be from food and not alcohol.
Okay.
No other industry, you know, you don't tell Macy's you have to sell 10% from shoes and another. But
did they think that that was going to make sure that the 18-year-olds that were in the bar or club were going to be eating but not drinking beer?
So I'm sure that was a thought. Yeah. About maybe a possible benefit from it. The problem was, as many of these terms had been in the licenses for years and years and were never enforced. But then when the state needed money, all of a sudden they were kind of knocking on the doors and trying to kind of change the landscape.
Yeah.
There was also a series of problems where one particular police officer in the city sort of had his own personal vendetta and
against a particular
not particular just the or? Just the kind of the music and nightlife scene in general.
Oh boy. Okay.
You know, thought that music and bars in the city were attracting unsavory people, and so there were reports of him sort of cracking down and confiscating laptops because the DJs he argued had stolen music. And so there was a bit of sort of less than noble enforcement going on.
Yes.
And that's where I really recognized, here are these musicians have a hard enough time trying to make a living.
Yeah.
They, you know, they're not able to make records anymore because half of the labels are gone and nobody likes radio anymore, so they can't get on airplay or, you know, the college stations are getting sold, so they stop playing college music.
Oh, because you had a particular campaign about one particular with the college station.
KUSF stuff.
Yeah.
Here, these musicians are struggling enough because of kind of the global pressures of the music industry.
Yeah.
And here locally, for totally different reasons, there's the possibility they don't even have small places to go play.
Yes.
And I really
Which is almost the last refuge has been taken away.
Exactly. I mean, I considered it the plankton of the ecosystem. But if bands don't even have anywhere to play, then it's hard for them to keep creating music, to write new songs, to record them, perform. Like, they don't even get started.
Yeah, that base of the ecosystem isn't there that everything else depends on.
Right. And so I began to get involved through the Recording Academy. I began to learn more of what the issues were. From there, I began to attend some of those Board of Supervisors meetings.
Okay.
That led to starting, we held forums for people running for office.
Okay.
So that they could become educated about issues facing the music community here in San Francisco.
Right.
So we began to educate the people on the Board of Supervisors. Last year, we held another forum for everybody running for mayor.
Yep.
We talked about music and nightlife and issues facing the music community.
'Cause let's face it, I mean, San Francisco is famous for its music scene and nightlife and
absolutely
being a what would you call it,
a long history of a
being
tradition,
an incubator for scenes and
right.
all sorts.
And so really that's been you know, my desire for, you know, enjoying music in a club and all my work in technology. I kind of felt it was time to give back, that we need to put time in helping musicians with the issues that affect them day to day.
That's great.
And that's been very rewarding and really successful. Earlier this year, again, kind of through all these efforts, the mayor's office held, they conducted an economic impact study.
Yeah.
And they looked at bars and nightclubs and live events and festivals, and then both the direct and the indirect impact to the city.
Yeah.
And how it increases tourism, it increases you know, people going to restaurants, taking cabs, staying in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that study reported $4.2 billion are brought to the city in one way or another through music and entertainment.
That's amazing.
So it was really rewarding to finally be able to not just talk about the sort of cultural impact and kind of but the...
to put a number on it, because, you know, if we were going to be cynical, that's possibly the only thing that they understand.
Exactly. And when they're talking about budgets and where do we put resources, you know, they look at, does it help? Does it help to the bottom line?
And it's not necessarily stuff. I mean, obviously there are times where they need a helping hand, but it's business that you can just leave alone and support in some way,
right?
Not actively try to shut down, and you've got this revenue coming in.
And we even joked that you know the music scene is still thriving here in San Francisco despite itself.
Yes.
That besides these other sort of just weird extraneous factors that kind of get in the way.
Mm.
You know, you look at this weekend is Hardly Strictly Blue Gosh Festival.
Right.
It's huge. You have Treasure Island next week.
It's
huge, bringing in global talent.
Absolutely.
You've got the Outside Lands Festival we had a couple weeks ago. Clearly, lots of people in the city like to enjoy music.
Yes.
And the mayor's office has begun to really appreciate that and recognize it. They've spent a number of years talking about sort of the redevelopment of San Francisco, of downtown, of how we get new businesses downtown, how we get people to live and stay in the city.
Yeah.
A big news item was, you know, Twitter having their office here in the city.
Oh, and yes.
Being able to stay.
And that was through kind of tax breaks or something, wasn't it? Like encouraging them to
And what they're downtown. Starting to recognize was... We want to attract companies like Twitter and Zynga and mm-hmm. technology companies.
Yeah.
Those people, part of why they work here and want to stay here is because when they're done working, there's interesting, fun things to do.
Yes.
There are neat restaurants. There are good clubs. There's nice music.
Well, it's this kind of complementary thing, isn't it? So people come to Outside Lands into Hardly Strictly Bluegrass for the music and for the thing itself, but it's also, it's San Francisco as well. So we can go there for the weekend, we can go and see some great music, but then we're also in San Francisco, this amazing city, with all this other stuff going on, and we can go to Alcatraz and do the tourist thing.
Right.
And so it's a cool place and a fun place anyway.
Right. And kind of all that, it's been really exciting. Just, again, another couple weeks ago, Bloomberg had announced a report. They had done a survey of the top cities in the country to live in, and San Francisco was number one.
And wow.
That was a rating of a whole bunch of different factors, from education and job opportunities, but also food and culture and art exhibits and music.
Yep.
And so it's kind of rewarding that a couple years ago the city just wasn't paying attention and music was in trouble, and now they're really recognizing that it's a core to the fabric, and it relates to everything else they're trying to do.
It seems so strange. I mean, I'm sure there's been stuff like that, not necessarily so concerted and obvious, but I'm sure there have been situations before in other cities, say in London or something, where we look back now and we're proud of a time when London was this thriving musical scene, whatever, like Carnaby Street in the 60s or something. But at the time, it maybe was seen as like, oh dear, this, you know, that's... These strangely dressed people and this terrible music. Oh dear, it's too loud or fast or whatever.
Right.
But now it's looked on as a great milestone in the cultural life of the city.
Hello, I'm Robin Deacon, and you're listening to The Coiled Spring.
This is a public service announcement by The Coiled Spring on behalf of the remnants of the British Empire and our expatriate agents everywhere. The following are the ingredients of Hostess Twinkie snack cakes from America. Enriched wheat flour, sugar, corn syrup, niacin, water, high fructose corn syrup. Vegetable and or animal shortening, containing one or more of partially hydrogenated soybean, cottonseed and canola oil, and beef fat. Dextrose, whole eggs, modified cornstarch, cellulose gum, whey, leavenings, sodium acid pyrophosphate, baking soda, monocalcium phosphate. Salt, cornstarch, corn flour, corn syrup, solids, mono and diglycerides, soy lecithin, polysorbate 60. Dextrin, calcium caseinate, sodium stearoyl lactylate, wheat gluten, calcium sulfate. Natural and artificial flavors, caramel color, yellow number 5, red number 40. This concludes this public service broadcast. Please stand for the national anthem.
I've gotten involved is that it really is a kind of complicated ecosystem that, you know, you have the art itself and kind of the people who create that.
Yeah.
But then you also have the business interests. You have the neighbors who live around the area.
Yeah.
And so you sort of have this competing, this young and single culture.
Mm-hmm.
You have this older and more mature and stable, and you know, kids.
Yes.
What's good for the kids?
Yeah.
Then you have the political structure. You have the police department.
Yeah.
You have all these permits around, you know, fire safety and noise and you know, what's the crowd capacity? And,
fire is a big thing. Yeah.
Even throw in public transportation.
Absolutely.
Buses and BART shutting down.
Yep.
And taxis, can you get them?
Well, I mean, we went to Cobb's Comedy Club on Friday. And it was great. Patton Oswalt, very funny. Some other great comedians there as well. But yeah, the show, we went to the second show, and the ticket said at 10:15. It didn't actually start till more like 10:45. So there was no way we were going to catch the last BART. Mm-hmm. So luckily we drove, but then you've got all the driving problems.
Right.
So whereas I went to another show, an improv comedy show a few weeks ago, and it said on the website, you know, tickets available here. Show starts at this time, and we finish in time for the last BART. They actually put it there. It's like, okay, that's great, because
right.
It's so important. You've got this whole And outside, in the when we were waiting in line to get into Cobb's, there's a coffee shop right on the corner, and we were thinking, I wonder if that's obviously a great place to have a coffee shop. We've got all these people waiting, a big line around the block. Yeah, it's all supporting each other.
And the trick is, when any individual group kind of gets too self-motivated, too self-centered, and that's where you start to have a lot of problems and a lot of tension. And the way you solve these problems is by actually learning more about the other side.
Yes.
Is actually listening to their arguments first.
Yeah.
And if you can, try to figure out some sort of middle ground that, you know, help people see the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier said than done.
I bet.
But, you know, and every couple of years there's a story of some neighbor who complains about noise and a club gets shut down for a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still, I find it amazing how some of the places where you see new construction, you see these new mm-hmm. condos and townhouses going in,
yep.
are the places near clubs and restaurants that are the cool parts of town.
Yeah, yeah.
And so first, the kind of the arts community is doing their own thing, and they're doing a great job, uh-huh. so good that some developer wants to build a condo place nearby.
Right.
They spend millions of dollars, put this building in, bring in a whole new group of people,
mm-hmm.
and then a year later they have a baby, and then they start calling the police, and yes. they try to make the club move.
Yeah.
It seems that's just human nature.
It's crazy, isn't it? But yeah, I think I know what you mean. There was I think it was the Daily Show, some story about a guy who complained because when he walked his little boy down the road, I think it was Castro Street that he was walking down, his little boy was looking in the shop windows, and it was shocking to see what was being sold. And it's like, you when did you move here? 2 years ago? And you moved, and the joke was that, so you moved to the gayest street in the gayest city in the gayest state of the gayest country in the world. Right. Maybe not that last bit.
Right.
And now you're complaining about it. Cool.
And where this has culminated in, so not only did we help kind of raise awareness to the problems that the clubs were having, and a number of groups got involved. There's another one called CMAC, the California Music and Culture Association, that mm-hmm. is really the clubs themselves actually organized for the first time to say to the city, look, we're having trouble here, we need help.
Yeah.
So we helped decrease the pressures from the city, we decreased the pressures from the state,
mm-hmm.
we got this economic impact study.
Yeah.
We've educated many of the board of supervisors and the current mayor.
Yeah.
And a couple months ago, the mayor approved a new budget for next year, and in that budget is a staff person to focus on the music and entertainment industry. So just like you have, people focusing on tourism mm-hmm. or focusing on hotels,
mm-hmm.
people focusing on biotech.
Yeah.
Now the city actually has someone focused on music and entertainment. And so
seems like an amazing oversight not to have had that already.
Right. Well, and you've had the Film Commission.
Yeah.
It's been involved. There is the SF Arts Commission.
Right.
That
kind I guess of, that's more, I don't know.
More opera and classical, exactly. And then a lot of visual arts and sculpture and
so
painting.
So it's SF MoMA and the Opera House and so on.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what you have is really a lot of different groups doing a lot of little things, not necessarily working together.
Yeah.
But now we have the potential for this position of somebody who can help actually start bringing them together.
So coordinate all that stuff and be a liaison to the arts community itself.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
So that's about it for episode 3. Tom and I talked about lots more stuff, including the complexities of music licensing. And I think what I'll do is do another episode just to cover all that ground, because there's lots of good stuff and we chatted about lots of interesting things. So that'll be kind of episode 3B. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time if tuning is still a valid paradigm. The Coiled Spring was created, edited, and presented by Matthew Petty and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. Music is by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com, and you can send suggestions, comments, requests, and demands to feedback@coiledspring.org. Thanks for listening.